Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It's the day after the elections, and earlier in the evening than expected, the presidential race was called, and President Barack Obama was elected to a second term. The GOP retained control of the House, and Democrats retained control of the Senate. Some historic decisions came in across the country yesterday. In Maryland and Maine, voters legalized gay marriage. Colorado and Washington State legalized marijuana, while California voted to amend the three strikes law, uphold the death penalty, and strike down a proposition to label GMO foods. Meanwhile, thousands of voters across the country reported difficulties at the polls from long lines, and Florida's results are still up in the air. So what races were you following, and how will that affect you and your community going forward? What are your hopes and fears for the next 4 years? Joining us to deconstruct the election, both in the state and nationally, we've got Brian Lubitz. He's a blogger for Calitix.com, which is a site for discussion of local and statewide politics. Brian started Calitix in September of 2005 because of what he saw as a lack of transparency in the state house. He says, while federal politics gets a lot of attention from national media and local politics from local media, state-level politics often misses out. Well, not today. Thank you for joining us, Brian.
Thank you very much.
And also joining us from D.C., we've got Andrea Seabrook, and she spent more than a decade at NPR. She's best known for her award-winning coverage of the U.S. Congress, and she's just started a new project, Decode D.C. Hi, Andrea. Are you there? Have we got Andrea?
I'm here.
Yay.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, let's start
with the national landscape, Andrea. Obama's win came pretty early, and it was very sweeping in the Electoral College. Was anybody expecting this, or did the media just hype up how close the contest was?
I think it's pretty clear that the media was, in the last few days, I think, stretching for a story. That this was, you know, it's true that it was close on the popular vote, although President Obama won that as well. You know, the news isn't very interesting when there isn't a story, and a story means conflict. And, you know, the truth is we're so used to elections being close that when it's close, it still looks like it's not close. But the truth is, this was something we generally expected from the polling that came out. Nate Silver of 538, the guy who is the numbers god, sort of had it all right.
The numbers god. Yeah, he's a blogger at NewYorkTimes.com. And so far, Barack Obama has 303 electoral college votes versus Mitt Romney's 206. However, Congress is still in the exact same position as it was before, with GOP controlling the House and Democrats controlling the Senate with just one vote margin and not a filibuster-proof Senate. So do you watch this gridlock for this past 4 years? Is anything going to change fundamentally, or what do you think will change?
Well, let me correct you a little bit. The gridlock was the last 2 years. The first
Excuse
two
me.
Years of Barack Obama's term, the Democrats had control of the House and the Senate and the White House, and they actually had an incredibly productive time, whatever you think of the politics. The last 2 years with the Republican control of the House have been, as you say, incredible, crazy gridlock. And it's to the great frustration of the majority of Americans, by the way, on both sides of the political spectrum. I think, you know, there's a tendency to think, oh, well, yawn, it's all the same. It's just going to be another 2 years of gridlock. But I think that this has it's been very clearly now the wind has been taken out of the Tea Party sails, at least for now. It took a good couple of years to sort of blow that out, that weather system out of Washington. And I think the fact that, that's sort of how a lot of people see it in Washington now. And I think that Barack Obama may have more leeway now, a little bit more bargaining in Washington, but you know, who knows? The House at this point is sort of an unpredictable beast.
I want to ask both of you about the impact of the money, more money spent than ever before in U.S. electoral politics. Citizens United, it's almost as if Citizens United had a defeat in this election in some way. There was $1 billion of PAC money spent. Two-thirds of it went toward Republican candidates. What do you think are the effects of Citizens United on this race? Why don't we start with you, Andrea, and then go to Brian?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think the politicos of the land, the ones who sort of thought that the more money you spend, the more votes you get, have been disproved. There is a point at which there is media saturation, and no matter how much money you spend, you can't get more. You can't get more. That said, I don't think we should underestimate the effects of Citizens United, because the truth is it still means that you have to spend $1 billion to get to that full saturation point. And it still means that anyone can be attacked at the very last minute, and no one ever knows who paid for the actual ads. And, you know, that whatever, it's bad for politicians, but that means that everyone builds up a bigger war chest to defend themselves up to the very end, and you get sort of an arms race when it comes to money. And that's no good for anybody. So I think you're right. There's some repudiation of Citizens United, but I think also, you know, there's a long road of campaign money ahead of us.
How about you, Brian? What's your opinion?
Well, I can certainly say in the state of California, we certainly saw the impact of the super PACs. Looking at Proposition 32, which I was actually on the campaign of,
How about reminding everybody what Prop 32 was?
Prop 32 was a measure that was sort of cynically drawn to claim that it was political reform, campaign finance reform, would ban contributions from unions and corporations, but it also banned payroll deductions, which are essentially exclusively a union fundraising vehicle. So it took away the money from unions, and there was
it was defeated,
and that would have that raised in the end $60 million from sort of a cycle of different super PACs through a couple Koch brothers related super PACs through an Arizona super PAC, which was then unmasked by the Fair Political Practice Commission here in California.
So this is $11 million funneled.
$11 million funneled to California. Exactly. And it was, it took the California Supreme Court to demand that they, you know, reveal their donors. And still, we don't know who the people were who gave this $11 million. We only know that it came through three different PACs, which is actually against the law in the state of California.
Well, are there, Andrea, maybe this one goes to you, are there smaller races in states where some of this PAC money may have had a much larger impact?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, there are, you know, especially the fact that the money is tilted so heavily towards the Republican side. There was a lot of those Tea Party candidates that needed to be shored up. The current thinking that I don't know if we have the exact returns on the Alan West race down in Florida right now, but no one thought he could get as close as he did before Super PAC money came through. And I think that's very, very interesting, watching the dynamics of that. At some point, I think very rich people have got to be asking themselves, what's the return on putting tens of millions of dollars into the hands of super PACs and, you know, big personalities like Karl Rove and others, who say they can get someone elected purely based on an advertising budget. And so perhaps that may change the game in the future as well. Perhaps super rich people might not have as much of a, they might not want to throw their money that direction. Who knows? That's another good question. There's a lot of money lost in this election.
That's Andrea Seabrook. She spent more than a decade at NPR, and she's best known for her award-winning coverage of the U.S. Congress. She's just started a new project, which is Decode DC. And we're also joined by Brian Lubitz, who's a blogger for Calitics.com, which is a site for discussion of local and statewide politics. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. And we're talking about the election, the results, and the impact. And we want to invite you to join our conversation. The number is 866-7 888-298-8255. It's a toll-free number. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcall.org. And how closely were you following the presidential race? And did you get involved politically in any way? Which races and local propositions have you been watching closely? Was there anything that surprised you about this election? 866-798-8255. Again, that's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Also, if you were one of the people who did not vote, let us know why. And if you voted for any of the third-party candidates, we'd also like to hear from you. And any questions that you have for our guests are our fair game here. 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number, or you can send us a note to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we just got an email from Jackie. She said Democrats had just lost a one-vote majority in the Senate. Not correct. There are 51 Democrats. I think that that's what I said, 51 Democrats in the Senate. That would make it 51-49. That's right. What they don't have is a filibuster-proof Senate. Apologies for that misstatement on my part. Go ahead, Andrew.
And there are a couple of independent senators now. We still have Bernie Sanders, and there's a brand new independent senator from Maine who won the election up there. And so for the first time, there will be a three-party Senate. So, you know, that'll be very interesting.
And here in California, there's also something really interesting that nobody thought was going to happen, which is the new composition of the legislature.
Yeah, actually, in both the Assembly and the Senate, it looks like we're going to have a two-thirds supermajority, which is going to be happening for the first time really since Proposition 13 made that important. Now, California Democrats will be in a position to pass a budget with or without additional revenues of their own accord. Whether they choose to do any additional revenue is, you know, it's still up in the air and seems, you know, unlikely given Proposition 30. But I think it's a huge surprise for many folks,
including Democrats.
I think there's a race down in Orange County. Sharon Quirk Silva, who was not expected to win and is now leading by over 1,000 votes. And this is have a huge difference in the state of California for the next 2 years.
And so what has really changed? So most Republicans in the state, or if not all, had taken this kind of Grover Norquist pledge to never raise taxes. Is that right?
Right. I think that's a big part of it. I think there's still, you know, there's a big thing about this year's elections was, first of all, the redistricting. So a lot of these districts, which were, you know, very, very gerrymandered in the last cycle. This time we have an election where both the districts are more fair, and then also that we had this online voter registration, which yielded almost a million new voters this cycle. And many of those voters came out to vote for Democrats.
And we have an email coming in saying, how many people came out and voted this year in comparison with 2008, both nationally and in California? Who voted at a higher rate than they did in 2008 and who didn't show up? Do you know anything about the demographics of this race? And I'm looking them up right now as we speak. Andrea?
I don't know exact turnout numbers, although we can look those up. I believe it was somewhat lower than in 2008, although not a huge drop. I do know that the Latino vote was much bigger this year than 4 years ago, and the white male section of the electorate was lower. It has been dropping steadily. That reflects demographics of the country, basically. Turnout among African Americans was very high, at least if you look at the historic numbers. And I can only say these sort of, sort of superlatives, high, low, because I don't have exact numbers in front of me. Sometimes it takes a while. I mean, there are still provisional ballots to be counted. There are still absentee ballots to be counted. It may be a week before we know real numbers on that.
There's still Florida. But we do know that demographics was a really big piece of this, and it's sort of a Californianization of the electorate nationally.
Actually, one of the things which I think was really important this cycle is that, you know, I think there was some expectation on the part of Republicans that millennial vote, which is the younger voters, would drastically reduce. And actually, it was up from 2008 from 18% to 19%. Not a substantial increase, but enough that's to say that those voters didn't just walk away from the political cycle.
Were these new voters, different voters from 2008?
I mean, I think it's, for the most part, it's the voters who came out for the wave of 2008 and Barack Obama. Many of them stay engaged, and in the younger voters who just became voters this time for their first vote also came out for this cycle because of perhaps, you know, for Obama, for whatever else.
So what a lot of pundits talked about, Andrea, which was this enthusiasm gap, that there wouldn't be that same kind of enthusiasm as there was in 2008. That didn't appear to materialize.
It didn't. And, you know, that's part of this sort of meta narrative here. As I was talking about the Tea Party and sort of blowing that wind out of Washington, it really, there was sort of a battle of coalitions. If you look at this from 30,000 feet, there was some question about whether these two movements generally, the sort of Democratic coalition with Barack Obama at the head and Nancy Pelosi in the House and Harry Reid in the Senate on one side, and then the Tea Party coalition, which one could really have staying power through an election that wasn't a wave election? Remember, in 2008, there was so much enthusiasm and huge expectations, and, you know, Barack Obama crashed across the country. I mean that in a good way for him. And then in 2010, there was a similar kind of enthusiasm on the other side. The question in this election was, okay, when we get back to normal here, emotions are somewhat lower, who sustains? And really, I think the Democratic coalition proved itself to be a mature movement in a lot of ways that can push forward into policy and governing, even when those policies aren't always loved by the electorate. They managed to capture enough, yes votes to get through. And there was some, you know, there was a much more lower enthusiasm level for the Tea Party people than there was in 2010. So that says a lot about where this country is going.
And that's Andrea Seabrook. She's just started a new project called Decode DC, and she's a longtime reporter with NPR covering the U.S. Congress. We're also joined by Brian Lubitz, who's a blogger for Calitics.com. And you can call us with all of your questions. I have an email here from Greg in Berkeley. Hi, everybody. The result that stunned me this morning, and one I didn't hear a single analyst mention in the election run-up, and Brian did mention this a little earlier today, Greg, is the Democrats winning a supermajority in the state assembly. The LA Times this morning says this is the first time a California political party has won a supermajority since 1933, which was also FDR's first presidential victory during the Great Depression.
I think what's really important is that in California, Republicans have actually dropped below 30%. In registration numbers, and in fact, California is on its way to becoming a Massachusetts-style one-party state. If the Republicans cannot overcome their sort of hawkishness on immigration and social issues, they have sort of, you know, in addition to the Grover Norquist, you know, tax issues, they have so isolated themselves onto one specific, you know, plank of the, you know, political extremism that they haven't been able to, you know, reach a centrist base where they can get them to anywhere near a majority in either house.
And let's go to some calls. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're doing a deconstruct of yesterday's election, both here in California and nationally. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to Your Call, David. You there? Do we have a phantom caller? David? So, just like with you at the beginning there. Okay, so let's go to Nick in San Francisco. Hi, Nick.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. I have been following ever since the 2000 debacle, which I immediately called, you know, a stolen election, with quite a bit of statistical analysis behind all that. The Help America Vote Act that's propagating these no-receipt touchscreen voting machines where the software that counts the votes cannot be independently audited. And I think we're being lulled into, as much as I support measuredly Obama, we're being lulled into this situation where there was massive voter suppression that went down. There were patches put into these machines. It always goes to the advantage of the Republicans. And we're not talking about the 80% of these three companies who make 80% of these voting machines to be propagated across the country are big partisans, in this case, Republican. And basically, safe voting, and I would just turn your attention to Brad Friedman, who's done incredible work on this, bradblog.com. Why are we not discussing in any roundtable on anything that has to do with our voting process that it's been given away to private corporations where we can't even independently audit the software that counts the votes? What are we thinking? We're sleepwalking here. I believe Obama probably actually won significantly more votes when you look at all the suppression tactics that were going on in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, et cetera. So when does this become the part of our national debate?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing that we can say in California is that that's not the case here in California. I mean, we have Deborah Bone, who is thoroughly investigated the voting machines and actually suspended several of those voting machines, which she did not find acceptable for security purposes. I know that discussion probably should be more present on the national level, but at the very least, the most populous state is considering the issue.
And what's happening? What do we know, Andrea, about what happened yesterday with regard to voter suppression, alleged voter suppression?
Well, there are always, reports of, small-time things happening. Now, don't get me wrong. It's all important. But the truth is the vote turned out pretty much what was expected based on good, solid polling and statistics nationwide. If there was some reason to believe that there was a bigger, conspiracy or a bigger voter fraud going on, then I think people would be on it like white on rice. But the truth is the numbers never quite bear out. And with machines like this, it's important to remember that, yes, these machines are vulnerable, especially when they're at the factory. But once they get out to voting places, they're not linked to the internet. They're not linked to each other. So you would have to go to every single machine in every single precinct to drop, a virus into it or whatever in order to make it vulnerable. It's much more difficult than people generally think it is to game this kind of system.
Do you think, though, that there might be an election reform move to take politics out of state elections officials who are now elected as partisans?
That is such a good question, and it really talks also to the redistricting process. I know, Brian, you talked a little bit about the districts being fairer. The reason why this is connected is because redistricting happens on a political level in most of the country also. It's not so much in California anymore, but, that's the same kind of question. How do you fix a system that is built on top of politics in the first place? How do you take the politics out of a system? How do you get a political party to vote against its own interests? And it takes demands from the people. And if anything, I think the people are getting closer to the kind of, fed up energy that you need to demand that kind of fealty to honesty and to a little bit of, rational thought anymore. I think, the fact that California is doing it a different way is a testament to that.
And that's Andrea Seabrook. She spent more than a decade at NPR, and she's best known for her award-winning coverage of the U.S. Congress. Seabrook was also the weekend host of All Things Considered and a frequent guest host of Talk of the Nation and Weekend Edition. Before that, she was a writer on and editor on Morning Edition, working with host Bob Edwards. And now she is host of Decode DC. And Brian Lubitz is a blogger with Calitics.com, which is a site for discussion of local and state politics. Brian started Calitics in September of 2005 because of what he saw as a lack of transparency in the State House. And today we're talking about how the election has changed the country and California. And it's our post-election roundup, the day after this historic election. We are talking with Brian and Andrea about the results. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We will be right back after this short break.
Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco, a show that depends on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And that's also where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How do you organize without a union? That will be the question that we'll take up tomorrow on Your Call. What are effective tactics for non-union workers, and what can we learn from the actions of Walmart workers and others who have been organizing for their rights without the structure of a traditional union? Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news, and that's what we are doing today in our post-election roundup. We're speaking with Brian Lupitz of Calitix and Andrea Seabrook, formerly with NPR, now with Decode DC. This has been one of the closest presidential races since 1960, and there were a lot of local propositions and measures on the California ballot that we will talk about. But what questions do you still have? You can join our discussion at 866-798-8255, or you can email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What surprised you about this election, and what are your hopes and fears for the next 4 years? 866-798-8255, and what questions do you have about the election results? And how closely were you following the presidential race? Did you volunteer for any of the campaigns? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number. And let me get to some of these calls and emails. So David in San Francisco wanted to know, given that Congress is in a deadlock, what can progressives do to try and take back the House? Andrea, why don't we go to you?
Well, I think that, work needs to be done if that's your aim for progressives to take back the House. You've got to get local. The House is a funny place, and it reflects local issues so much more than it reflects, it reflects 435 local races. And local races are really, really different from national races. And I would hesitate to make your aim even, let's take back the House, except that you need to remember that in a lot of places, people think really differently, and they are part of the American patchwork, the American, quilt, to use a sort of tired cliche. But, those people are important, and you have to make your ideas understandable and appealing to more people in more places. That's the basic challenge there.
I would say two things. First of all, one of the things Republicans did very well over the last 10 years was to really look at redistricting and how that happened in 2010. They were kind of hoping in California that they'd be able to pick up some districts with Governor Schwarzenegger's redistricting measure. It actually ended up favoring Democrats. But, if you look at Texas, I grew up in Texas, and the redistricting process there is not as fair as it is here in California, and they redistrict in the middle of the cycle. And if you look at states across the country, the redistricting process is very tilted one way or the other, and because of the enormous gains for Republicans in 2010, much of that is towards Republicans. So I think if progressives really want to reach forward towards a long-term House majority, I think part of that is working, sort of not in the short term and sort of giving up some of that aspect, but really looking forward towards how do we make sure in 2020 that we don't get, sort of blitz like we did in 2010.
And that gets back to electoral reform. Here is another email from John, who says he voted for Jill Stein. I don't understand California liberals. How else to explain yes on Obama, yes on the death penalty, no on food safety, that's the labeling of GMO foods, no on marriage equality. Can California NAACP, I didn't know that was on the ballot this time. California NAACP came out against Prop 37, the GMO labeling. Incredible. Will they now challenge Obama on his extrajudicial assassinations and his expanding his wars? So that's a comment largely on the California
right.
propositions.
Well, first of all, I think California progressives aren't necessarily majority in where, I think there's a big swing percentage of where there's voters who, favor organized labor, but then also are a little touchy about the death penalty. I'm actually impressed with the percentage that the death penalty measure got. It was 47%, which is, relatively close. And I think in the long to maybe mid-range, I think we can also actually get the death penalty overturned in California. But I think, if you look at how President Obama is concerned and how this is his presidency for progressives, obviously there's a wave of progressives in the Netroots and the grassroots who don't support President Obama because of the extrajudicial killings and those issues. But to some extent, there's also the even scarier prospect of a President Romney. I think that scared many of those folks away.
And how do you read the California ballot passing Proposition 30 to fund schools, throwing down Proposition 32, which would have essentially banned union contributions or made it much more difficult, then upholding the death penalty and yet reforming three strikes?
Well, as part of this is money, right? So where there was a lot of money, I think that drew a lot of attention. Proposition 32 had, roughly $50 million on each side. Labor made a strong case as to why, labor is important in California. Then also why, if you want to do political reform, you have to do it honestly. And with Proposition 30, the governor has, over the last 18 months, 2 years, reached out in a enormous way throughout the state and really addressed many of the budget concerns, made drastic cuts in the state. And really, you can't go much further than he has gone in terms of cuts. Had we done another $6 billion of cuts, $7 billion of cuts, the pain to education, K-12 education, higher education, and community colleges would have been decimating for the long-term future of California.
And will this solve California's education funding?
Basically, I think what this gives California legislators is 5 years to fix the problem, especially with a 2/3 majority in the Senate and in the Assembly. I think Democrats, it is now incumbent upon them to come up with a long-term solution. This is not it. This is only a 5-year reprieve. When these revenues go away, after the 5 years, there needs to be a system in place where the budget is sustainable without having to go through this every 5 years.
And that's possible potentially because of the change in the legislature.
Exactly. With a 2/3 majority, Democrats themselves can pass these kind of big reforms and big structural and big revenue measures, which could not have happened, 2 months ago.
And let's go to more callers. David in San Rafael, welcome to your call.
Thank you very much, Holly. I wanted to tell you a local story about volunteers doing election integrity work in Ohio. Unfortunately, your guest Andrea was quite naive in her understanding of how elections are stolen. They can be stolen at the Secretary of State level, where the results from the counties are integrated. We had around 50 volunteers recording the output of each of the county boards of elections and putting the totals into spreadsheets that were publicly available. And the idea was that we were recording evidence that could have been used had there been an attempt to steal the election. And so this is a way of fighting back. There is a great deal of evidence to support the notion that the 2004 election was stolen in Ohio.
Andrea, do you want to address that? Go ahead and stay on the line, David.
I think that's fabulous. I love the new sort of scrappy hacking internet movement out there that takes data that used to only be in the hands of, frankly, partisans, just like you're saying. There is a lot of power in that. Absolutely. I think that is a hallmark of American democracy, and I think it's fabulous. My only comment was just about how it's harder to hack the voting machines than I think some people think. And but seriously, I think that's fabulous. I think it's great.
And just one more question, Andrea, regarding this. There was also a lot of talk about these voter monitors intimidating voters. Did you hear mm-hmm. much about that?
I haven't heard much about it. Smatterings of stories here and there. And I think the fact that people now there was an account of a voting machine yesterday that was one of those where you press a button and it would immediately vote for another candidate. It was badly calibrated. And, somebody whipped out their phone and took a video of it happening and uploaded it to the internet. It's just, you know, that's great. That's this is a safeguard of our democracy at work. And that's not to say that we should get complacent or that I'm naive about the fact that people will steal elections. I lived in Mexico for many years, and I know all about that kind of stuff. It's just that I love this sense that we should all be watchdogs, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's, I actually saw that video as well, and I think it's great that a lot of folks are actually filming their video, their voting experiences. Actually, that's illegal in some states, which I think we should address and repeal those laws. But then also, one more thing, I think voter suppression isn't just in voting booths. I mean, I think if you look at the voter ID laws, if you look at the, you know, the many other myriad of restrictions in Ohio, the Secretary of State was basically openly defying a three-judge panel of federal judges, saying it is actually incumbent upon the voter to make sure their voter ID was recorded properly rather than the monitors, the poll workers. And what's going to threaten to disenfranchise, you know, any voter who didn't make sure that their ID was recorded properly. You know, I think there's, as you addressed earlier with the Secretary of State issue, these are partisan people. And, you know, Ken Blackwell said the same thing. You know, we are elected as partisan, and we should, he actually said that he is comfortable with that.
Running the elections
running
as
the election
a partisan.
As a partisan operation. And, you know, I think going forward, you know, there's been a lot of work in the progressive side of, you know, Secretary of State project is one of those projects to actually address getting, you know, Secretary of States who treat the system with respect and without such a partisan tilt.
And I want to get to more of our callers. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm joined by Brian Liebitz, who's a blogger and founder of Calitics.com, and Andrea Seabrook, who's a former NPR reporter and is now the host of Decode DC. And we are decoding yesterday's election. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we're at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Let us know how you were following the presidential race and if you got involved politically. A lot of people are telling us that they did. 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the results of this election, both here in California and the impact of that and nationally? And what surprised you? What are your hopes and fears for the next 4 years? And if you're somebody who didn't vote at all, do give us a call and tell us why. 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let me go to Gail in Menlo Park. Hi, Gail.
Oh, hi there. Yes, I agree that one of your guests has seriously downplayed the insecurity of elections. In San Mateo County, where I live, people generally think that it's well-run. Yet, I refer to it as faith-based voting because they scrambled the precincts so much that hundreds and hundreds of people went to the wrong precinct. There was no public service announcement warning people to study their voting materials carefully to see where their voting precinct was this year, so that people in wheelchairs, people who could barely walk, showed up at the wrong polling place and were very disconcerted.
What happened when they showed up at the wrong polling place?
Well, they can fill out a provisional ballot, but again, that's what I call faith-based voting. You fill this thing out, and then once it leaves your hands, who knows what happens to it? It's certainly not possible to review these, which they need to do, and include them in the tally anytime soon, so that the results of all these elections are called without large numbers of votes being tallied. And the move in my county is to push people into this kind of voting, either provisionals by scrambling the precincts or mail-in ballots. In fact, some of the precincts have been eliminated. People can no longer go to the polling place. They must vote with one of these mail-in ballots. And everything I read indicates that the old-fashioned way of counting the ballots at the precinct, which was usually done in many, many places, especially in Europe, in the presence of witnesses, you get a definitive, well-documented result.
You know, You know, one thing that I've seen is the increase. I mean, obviously, you know, you've seen it as well, is the increasing presence of mail-in voting. And actually, there's some states where it's all mail-in voting.
Yeah.
The response has actually been quite positive there.
People don't know what they're doing. I mean, they don't understand how insecure it is.
You know, I mean, I think there obviously are concerns with any election system, and I think I think any attempts to really be sure, you know, to be totally sure that, you know, 100 years ago we had incredibly secure elections is probably a little naive as well. You know, I think we can, there are witnesses and you can verify the system to some extent, but, you know, as you said, there are checks. The greatest checks are that we have an incredible polling system in the United States right now, where we can tell at least the very high levels that nothing is really going that out of the ordinary. Polls, while not perfect, are a very good check on how our system works.
Well, and they're still counting the votes in Florida. Go ahead, Andrea.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think it's really important, something that we all learn every time we talk to people who are very anxious about this, and that is, in general, across the country, everywhere, there is an uneasiness about the system of voting, just the logistics of it itself and whether it is partisan. The idea that partisan fierce fighting has trickled down and sunk into the deepest levels of our democracy, the levels that used to just be, I'm an American, I'm the Secretary of State, I'm here to uphold the law first, and a partisan second, or I'm a poll worker, I'm here to make sure that voting, that democracy happens, not one side or the other. It's very interesting to me that anxiety and in some cases the partisanship itself has sunk so deeply into our culture. I think I blame that a lot on how far politicians are willing to go to win, because when they tear down the government in order to win an election, they call into question the very basic fundamentals of law and democracy. The law itself starts to look partisan.
Well, I mean, it's very difficult. I think in defense of some of these folks, I think that if you look at 2000, you look where, you know, essentially what is later after the fact determined to be, you know, Al Gore won Florida by 590 votes. I don't think it's particularly surprising, given Catherine Harris's role in Florida's elections that year, that people are a little skeptical.
And yet we have not reformed any of those laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think it's surprising at all either. I think it's interesting.
Well, let's talk about some of the historic nature of this election and some of the really Maryland and Maine upheld gay marriage, Colorado and Washington legalized marijuana. What, 10 women elected to the Senate, I believe it was. What do you see as historic changes and their effects, both Andrea and Brian?
Well, you know, I think it's really hard to underestimate the importance of the marriage equality measures. As actually one of the 18,000 LGBT couples married here in California in 2008,
Congratulations.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's incredibly important that here in California, we can look forward to, you know, hopefully when the Supreme Court eventually strikes down Prop 8 for good, I think we can look forward to using these measures, using the fact that now Americans have said that marriage equality is something as a majority we all prefer. In many of these states, I think that is a stepping stone forward towards, if you look at how Loving versus Virginia happened in the 60s, in the 50s, it was because 18 states had already legalized interracial marriage. And I think as we move forward towards, you know, a plane in throughout the country, I think that these elections are incredibly important for the judiciary itself.
Andrea?
Yeah, I think it's really incredibly important that it wasn't a wedge issue this year. Even in the places where you would expect it to be a wedge issue, it wasn't a wedge issue. And that says something about the culture of the United States and the step that it's taken towards normalizing those kinds of relationships culturally. I think it's really fascinating, and Maine and Maryland speak very loudly to that, I believe. There weren't, you know, what's interesting, there weren't very many wedge issues at all, wedge social issues, basically. I mean, there was
except maybe abortion rights.
Yeah, well, and more, I think the Republicans got into the hot water with questioning the rights of contraception. I mean, they sort of went back 40 or 50 years with their rhetoric. But, you know, that's really interesting that it wasn't actually on the ballot anywhere. You know, the wedge issues, to be a true, you know, ballot-turning measure, getting out the vote, you have to have it on the ballot in places. And even in the places where some of these were on the ballot, it didn't turn into the great vote-getter for Romney as Republicans would have liked. So that says something about the maturity of the electorate and its ability to know when it's being manipulated and to know when it's things are, you know, what they seem. I think in California, the fact that the GMO question went down speaks to how much money was thrown into that just in September and October. I mean, tens of millions of dollars.
And that was that California's was, Proposition
absolutely.
37.
And, you know, and Prop 37 was really decimated by that money.
Yes, and it could have been a nationwide wave. I was watching that particularly. I had Michael Pollan on my show before the election, and you know, that could have been a watershed moment for the food movement and changes in food policy. But again, big money can come in and push something like that down. And I think it takes a few cycles, like with marriage equality and other issues, for Americans to get a little more, you know, seasoned about the manipulation that happens in these elections.
You know, I think that's a great point. First of all, with Prop 37 specifically, yeah, I think it's always easier to run a no campaign. So they were able to say, oh, this is going to raise your grocery bills by $400. The evidence was scant, to say the least. You know, and 30-some-odd countries in Europe and throughout the world have GMO labeling restrictions already without, you know, these kind of increased costs. You know, and with respect to marriage equality, you know, actually, Nate Silver actually predicted much of this in the past. He actually, you know, you can go back to some of his earlier archives and show that he has sort of dates when each state will go across the 50% line for marriage equality. And if you look back in 2004, when Senator Feinstein, you know, California senator, actually was lambasting San Francisco's mayor, Gavin Newsom, for pushing marriage equality. And if you look at the 2012 Democratic Convention, half the speakers all spoke about the marriage equality issue on the other side. It's really an amazing transformation.
And let me give out our number just one more time. 866-798-8255 is the number to call, or you can email us. I've got an email here that I'm going to read in just a moment. Again, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And we're specifically asking, what are your reactions to yesterday's election results? What do you think is historic? What do you think still needs to change? And then we have an email here. The ballot described Prop 35 as simply a bill that increases penalties for human traffickers. Who would oppose that? Yet many sex workers came out against it. We hosted a debate here, and lots of people who are against human trafficking also thought that it might have unintended consequences along the lines of the Third Strikes lawsuit. Can you talk about that, Brian?
Yeah, I actually voted against it myself as well. I think the bigger concern about it with some of the more traditional human trafficking opponents was that it sort of intervened in a system that was actually kind of working pretty well on a number of fronts. I think maybe some enforcement could be done better here and there. But there is a system of definitions and in legal processes that are generally working pretty well and sort of threw a big monkey wrench in there, which probably wasn't necessary.
And Andrea, we just have a couple of minutes left, so I'd like to get final thoughts from both you and Brian about the significance of this election and how we should look at it and how it's going to affect our country going forward.
I think it's very significant. I think you could see a new reality of what is sort of decided law in a way in the United States and what is really sort of an old way of looking at our culture. I think it's interesting that a lot of these social issues have pushed through the sort of emotional you know, the emotional crisis stage. And I think it could be that this clears, though it doesn't look like a really exciting election in some ways, it could clear out the cobwebs for a move forward. I also think if you had to pick one winner from this election cycle and all of the chatter and the chatty chat of the media and so on, I think it would be Nate Silver. And there's this fabulous meme on Twitter right now and Facebook. Is Nate Silver a witch? Because he correctly predicts everything all the time.
All right, Nate Silver is the big winner. How about you? Final thoughts, Brian, on the significance of this. You started off by saying, you know, the change in the California state legislature is huge.
Well, I mean, I think one thing which Andrea alluded to earlier, which was demographics. California was a little bit ahead of the nation as a whole, but I think we're looking at a demographic shift in America as a whole, where we are looking at with Latino and Asian voters strongly, strongly Democratic right now. Asian voters, which is sort of an underestimated population, went 3 out of 4 voted for President Obama. And you know, this is a
Latino voters, I believe, is 75%.
75% as well, over 75%. I mean, this is you know, if Republicans really don't look at how they're representing a broader coalition instead of just representing, you know, what is a now coalition of white men, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them to win. To thread a political needle in future presidential elections to win an electoral college majority.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Brian Lubitz. He's a blogger and founder of Calitics.com, and we'll put a link to that. Thank you so much for being with us, Brian.
Thank you.
And Andrea Seabrook, who's a former NPR reporter and now the host of Decode DC, which we will also put a link at our website. Thank you, Andrea.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll put all of those resources at yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments there and continue this conversation. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Thanks for your emails and calls. I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow.
How do you organize without a union? On the Next Year Call, we'll talk about effective organizing tactics for non-union workers. Internal Walmart documents show that the company fears employee uprisings. They have no collective bargaining power. Are their tactics working? What can we learn from their actions or those of other non-unionized workforces? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Have you organized in the workplace without being in a union? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hart is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.